Državni izpitni center.
Splošna matura 2015.
Preverjanje slušnega razumevanja.
Lepo pozdravljeni. Pričenja se reševanje maturitetne izpitne pole slušnega razumevanja angleščine.
Izpitna pola je sestavljena iz dveh delov, dela A in dela B. Vsak del vsebuje govorjeno izhodiščno besedilo in nalogo, ki se nanj nanaša. Najprej boste nalogo prebrali in jo nato med poslušanjem besedila sproti reševali. Vsako besedilo boste poslušali po dvakrat. Začetek in konec besedila bo označeval takle zvočni znak.
Rešitve, ki jih pišite z nalivnim peresom ali s kemičnim svinčnikom, vpisujte v izpitno polo v zato predvideni prostor. Pišite čitljivo in skladno s pravopisnimi pravili. Če se zmotite, napisano prečrtajte in rešitev zapišite na novo. Nečitljivi zapisi in nejasni popravki bodo ocenjeni z nič točkami.
Zaupajte vase in v svoje zmožnosti. Želimo vam veliko uspeha.
Poslušajte pozorno. Odprite izpitno polo.
Section A. You will hear an interview with John Williams talking about Eartha Kitt, an international performer. You will hear the recording twice. Now read the task.
Eartha Kitt was born in 1927 in the cotton fields of South Carolina, and she died in Connecticut on Christmas Day 2008. Now, she never really knew her parents and was raised by various relatives, but found her way to New York and a career that led to Orson Welles famously casting her as Helen of Troy and calling her the most exciting woman in the world. Well, her biographer is John Williams, the author of America's Mistress, The Life and Times of Eartha Kitt. And yes, John, she did also play Catwoman in Batman, but we don't really want that to be her epitaph, do we?
Well, no, it's funny. I think she said later on that, you know, there's a job she did in one day that's the most famous thing that she stuck with, you know, playing a cat, as she said. You know, how do you research being a cat? I have no idea. You just find it inside you. But yeah, there's so much more to Eartha Kitt. It's funny. I mean, I grew up in the 60s and 70s hearing on the radio now and again and, you know, seeing her in Catwoman. And he just had no idea where this woman came from, really. Was she black or white? Was she American, European? She just seemed to come from planet glamour.
Well, what do we know for sure about her early life?
Well, this is the thing. I was amazed to find there'd never been a biography written of Eartha Kitt before. And her own autobiography is really vague about the early life. She left the South when she was eight, so she just had a strange mix of impressions rather than real memories. So I went down to South Carolina to see what I could find out.
And who did you meet?
I met an old lady called Mildred Amaker, who had picked cotton with Eartha when they were 6 or 7 years old. 100 pounds of cotton a day, and you got beaten if you failed to do it. And that's, I actually tried picking a piece of cotton while I was there. It practically tears your hand off. So how a child did this, I've no idea. But I then discovered that, who Eartha's father must have been.
Believed to be, I think, the local doctor, is that right?
That's right. Eartha's mother, when she was 16, was working as a maid for the local doctor and got pregnant. And that was a terrible scandal in the community. So
in the end, Eartha was sent away, went to live with another relative in New York, and eventually went to a college. Now, this is an important part of her life, isn't it? This all-black college she went to.
Well, what happened first? She got a couple of breaks in New York. I mean, first it was a tremendous break to be called for by her aunt. Then she went to the Metropolitan High School, which is what became, you know, the Fame School, the New York School of Performing Arts. And from there, she just happened to be hanging out in Harlem one day and met a girl who was in a dance group, a new dance group called the Catherine Dunham Company, which was the first African-American dance company who really celebrated the African roots of black America, which was something, you know, most people were ashamed of at the time. And they were a big hit on Broadway. And then in 1948, they came to Europe for the first time, just the same year as the Empire Windrush. And they were just this enormous hit. London was completely wowed by this group of fantastically beautiful and talented black dancers and singers.
And how soon was it clear that there was something very special about her? When did she become an individual performer?
Well, it was really in Europe that she started to make her move. They realised that she could sing as well as dance. She had a solo spot in London, and she was a big hit. And then they went to Paris, and Paris has a great tradition of loving African-American artists. Josephine Baker had been a huge star there before the war.
Now you will hear the recording again.
Arthur Kitt was born in 1927 in the cotton fields of South Carolina, and she died in Connecticut on Christmas Day 2008. Now, she never really knew her parents and was raised by various relatives, but found her way to New York and a career that led to Orson Welles famously casting her as Helen of Troy and calling her the most exciting woman in the world. Well, her biographer is John Williams, the author of America's Mistress, The Life and Times of Arthur Kitt. And yes, John, she did also play Catwoman in Batman, but we don't really want that to be her epitaph, do we?
Well, no, it's funny. I think she said later on that, you know, there's a job she did in one day that's the most famous thing that she stuck with, you know, playing a cat, as she said, you know. How do you research being a cat? I have no idea. You just find it inside you. But yeah, there's so much more to Arthur Kitt. It's funny. I mean, I grew up in the 60s and 70s hearing on the radio now and again and, you know, seeing her in Catwoman. And he just had no idea where this woman came from, really. Was she black or white? Was she American, European? She just seemed to come from planet glamour.
Well, what do we know for sure about her early life?
Well, this is the thing. I was amazed to find there'd never been a biography written of Arthur Kitt before. And her own autobiography is really vague about the early life. She, you know, she left the South when she was eight, so she just had a strange mix of impressions rather than real memories. So I went down to South Carolina to see what I could find out.
And who did you meet?
I met an old lady called Mildred Amaker, who had picked cotton with Arthur when they were 6 or 7 years old. 100 pounds of cotton a day, and you got beaten if you failed to do it. And that's, I actually tried picking a piece of cotton while I was there. It practically tears your hand off. So how a child did this, I've no idea. But I then discovered that, who Arthur's father must have been.
Believed to be, I think, the local doctor, is that right?
That's right. Arthur's mother, when she was 16, was working as a maid for the local doctor and got pregnant. And that was a terrible scandal in the community. So
in the end, Arthur was sent away, went to live with another relative in New York, and eventually went to a college. Now, this is an important part of her life, isn't it? This all-black college she went to.
Well, what happened first? She got a couple of breaks in New York. I mean, first it was a tremendous break to be called for by her aunt. Then she went to the Metropolitan High School, which is what became, you know, the Fame School, the New York School of Performing Arts. And from there, she just happened to be hanging out in Harlem one day and met a girl who was in a dance group, a new dance group called the Catherine Dunham Company, which was the first African-American dance company who really celebrated the African roots of black America, which was something, you know, most people were ashamed of at the time. And they were a big hit on Broadway. And then in 1948, they came to Europe for the first time, just the same year as the Empire Windrush. And they were just this enormous hit. London was completely wowed by this group of fantastically beautiful and talented black dancers and singers.
And how soon was it clear that there was something very special about her? When did she become an individual performer?
Well, it was really in Europe that she started to make her move. They realised that she could sing as well as dance. She had a solo spot in London, and she was a big hit. And then they went to Paris, and Paris has a great tradition of loving African-American artists. Josephine Baker had been a huge star there before the war.
This is the end of Section A. Section B. You will hear an interview with Michael Benton, a paleontologist, talking about dinosaurs. You will hear the recording twice. Now read the task.
What's not to love about fossils, particularly dinosaur fossils? My guest today is Michael Benton, a man who knows more about the subject than most. The seeds for Mike's career as a paleontologist were sown when, at the tender age of 7, he picked up a book about fossils. Subsequent family holidays near Whitby in Yorkshire were spent fossil hunting. And now, half a century later, he's still at it. His career has taken him around the world to learn and discover more about dinosaurs, what they looked like and how they behaved, than anyone thought possible simply by examining bits of old rock. He's studied some of the most cataclysmic events in Earth's geological history. It's a sobering thought that just a few degrees rise in global temperature, triggered by geological events 250 million years ago, led to a mass extinction that wiped out nearly all life on the planet. Alongside his academic research at the University of Bristol, Mike has worked tirelessly to satisfy the public's, both young and old, fascination and enduring love affair with dinosaurs. From children's books to big-budget TV documentaries, he knows that science can and should be explained at many different levels. Mike, welcome to The Life Scientific.
Hello.
I think as true today as it was when we were young, that many children get hooked on science by first falling in love either with astronomy and space travel or dinosaurs or both. Why do you think it is that dinosaurs continue to capture the imagination of the young?
That's a very tricky one. I remember, for example, after the film Jurassic Park, there was a great demand for talks and books and everything. And many people said, oh, well, this will just be a passing phase. In 3 or 4 years' time, it'll be all forgotten. And then along came Walking with Dinosaurs and then other events. And I think it's solid. I think it's there. And probably in this country, at least, it's existed since the 1850s when Richard Owen set up the first full-scale models, the famous Crystal Palace models, life-size dinosaurs made of concrete. Young boys, young girls, I think probably they love stories from a young age, miraculous and wonderful beasts and dragons. This is the normal answer. And then they discover at the age of 4 or 5, actually these dragons were real. And mummy and daddy can take me to the museum, I can see them. I suppose it's that kind of crossover between the fantastical and the real.
And as I mentioned in the introduction, the seeds for your career in paleontology were sown when you were very young.
Yes, and I suppose, I don't know, I'm sure there must be some children aged 7 who hate dinosaurs, and good luck to them. I was one of the majority, I suppose, who loved them, but unusual in that I didn't grow out of it.
Your obsession with fossils only grew stronger as you got older, and you decided to study geology at Aberdeen University. But I gather the course wasn't quite what you'd hoped for.
I was born in Aberdeen, and the standard expectation in Scotland was you go to your local university. I remember at our school, it was more or less at the beginning of sixth form, hands up if you want to go to university. Half the class put their hands up, and they handed out application forms for Aberdeen University. At that time, UCAS was the standard university entrance system. was not as well established as it is now. And that was it. And it's a very good geology department, but because of its location and industry pressures, it specialised in what we call hard rocks, granite. It is the granite city, after all. And then as I began my course, it was just the beginning of the oil boom, and they then picked up and continue today as very strongly industry-oriented, and quite right too. But that wasn't exactly my interest.
Now you will hear the recording again.
What's not to love about fossils, particularly dinosaur fossils? My guest today is Michael Benton, a man who knows more about the subject than most. The seeds for Mike's career as a paleontologist were sown when, at the tender age of 7, he picked up a book about fossils. Subsequent family holidays near Whitby in Yorkshire were spent fossil hunting. And now, half a century later, he's still at it. His career has taken him around the world to learn and discover more about dinosaurs, what they looked like and how they behaved, than anyone thought possible simply by examining bits of old rock. He's studied some of the most cataclysmic events in Earth's geological history. It's a sobering thought that just a few degrees rise in global temperature, triggered by geological events 250 million years ago, led to a mass extinction that wiped out nearly all life on the planet. Alongside his academic research at the University of Bristol, Mike has worked tirelessly to satisfy the public's, both young and old, fascination and enduring love affair with dinosaurs. From children's books to big-budget TV documentaries, he knows that science can and should be explained at many different levels. Mike, welcome to The Life Scientific.
Hello.
I think as true today as it was when we were young that many children get hooked on science by first falling in love either with astronomy and space travel or dinosaurs or both. Why do you think it is that dinosaurs continue to capture the imagination of the young?
That's a very tricky one. I remember, for example, after the film Jurassic Park, there was a great demand for talks and books and everything. And many people said, oh, well, this will just be a passing phase. In 3 or 4 years' time, it'll be all forgotten. And then along came Walking with Dinosaurs and then other events. And I think it's solid. I think it's there. And probably in this country, at least, it's existed since the 1850s when Richard Owen set up the first full-scale models. The famous Crystal Palace models, life-size dinosaurs made of concrete. Young boys, young girls, I think probably they love stories from a young age, miraculous and wonderful beasts and dragons. This is the normal answer. And then they discover at the age of 4 or 5, actually these dragons were real. And mummy and daddy can take me to the museum, I can see them. I suppose it's that kind of crossover between the fantastical and the real.
And as I mentioned in the introduction, the seeds for your career in paleontology were sown when you were very young.
Yes, and I suppose, I don't know, I'm sure there must be some children aged 7 who hate dinosaurs, and good luck to them. I was one of the majority, I suppose, who loved them, but unusual in that I didn't grow out of it.
Your obsession with fossils only grew stronger as you got older, and you decided to study geology at Aberdeen University. But I gather the course wasn't quite what you'd hoped for.
I was born in Aberdeen, and the standard expectation in Scotland was you go to your local university. I remember at our school, it was more or less at the beginning of sixth form, hands up if you want to go to university. Half the class put their hands up, and they handed out application forms for Aberdeen University. At that time, UCAS was the standard university entrance system. Was not as well established as it is now. And that was it. And it's a very good geology department, but because of its location and industry pressures, it specialised in what we call hard rocks, granite. It is the granite city, after all. And then as I began my course, it was just the beginning of the oil boom, and they then picked up and continue today as very strongly industry-oriented, and quite right too. But that wasn't exactly my interest.
This is the end of section B.
Končuje se slušno preverjanje angleščine. Nehajte pisati, zaprite izpitno polo in jo skupaj z ocenjevalnim obrazcem položite na rob mize.
Nasvidenje in srečno.